Hey, a question for you to get us started this morning. Who has most influenced your life? Now, you don't have to answer a lot. I want you to think about this. Who is it that has most influenced who you are today? Now, this actually could be a number of people, but when you think back, I mean, who are the people that most shaped the direction that your life took? Right? I think back over 50 years. The answer to that question, a lot of them are ones you would expect, right? Your parents, people like that. But then every once in a while, someone comes into your life that you maybe didn't expect. And I still remember it was almost 30 years ago. It was very soon after Yvonne and I were married. We moved as part of a job and went to a church and met a guy, very much a peer my age, but he was going through this whole journey on how he was experiencing God. And so he had these interesting views that were completely different from what I grew up with. And it's just interesting, the guy's name was Scott, and we kind of became friends, never close friends, but enough that we talked, and he began to share with me some of the things that he was learning and seeing, and it literally took everything I thought and kind of blew it up. And all of a sudden, I started asking questions I'd never asked before and looking at things the way I'd never looked at them before, and to this day, I can say there was one little shift in my life right there by running into that guy. Right? Most of us have those kinds of stories, and they happen over time. So let me ask you this question, which maybe is a little harder. Where have you done that for other people? Huh. How many of you, if I said, I'm going to go into the world and talk to people, and they're going to say, oh yeah, that person that did that for me was you. How many of you think you'd ever come up in anybody's conversation? I wonder. See, if we're lucky, someone would have shared that with us. Some of you have had that where someone came up to you and said, oh my, you've been so influential. This is what you said. This is what you did. This is how it helped me. I'm so appreciative. Some of us get that. Not very often we don't hear that. And then sometimes it's really obvious. I was at a training this week for police chaplaincy. And it's interesting to listen to the guy. We actually got trained by the guy who started the whole program back in 2007. And it's interesting because this is a program now that's all over New Jersey, the Attorney General's office, all through Pennsylvania, Delaware. It's now going across the country. And it all started because a guy just said, I want to help my police force in Vineland. So here's a guy who could look now and say, I know I've had an influence because you can see the actual results of the things you're doing. But failing that, I wonder sometimes, if we get into a place where we don't really understand the impact we have, and the temptation is to think that we have no impact and we have no opportunity for impact. But the story of Esther that we're going to look at is simply this. God has put you where you are right now, for such a time as this. And so the way we're going to do this morning is a little bit different. Because every single one of you can influence positively the lives around you. And so it's demonstrated in the story of Esther. Now, Esther, I got to kind of put this in context before we do the story. It takes place between about 483 and 473 BCE. 100 years earlier, if you take a look at this, the southern kingdom of Israel had been conquered by Babylon. So they'd gone in, they'd been conquered, they'd been taken away into exile, and now it's about 100 years later. Because what happened was after they got captured, about 70 years after they'd been put into exile, a bunch of them come back to Jerusalem. They come back to live in the homeland. But a lot of people didn't. A lot of Israelites just kind of stayed where they were. They were in the other country. And so by this point, these people who'd ignored God's call to return home, they were there, but it was no longer Babylon. Babylon had been conquered by Persia. So Persia was now the world power that was in place at this time. And so the events of Esther, and there's a book in your Bible by that name, take primarily in the capital of Susa, the capital of the Persian Empire. But there's some very interesting facts about Esther. Esther is the only book in the Bible that never mentions God. Not once. You never hear his name, never see it. The New Testament, which quotes from almost every book in the Old Testament, never quotes from Esther. And interestingly enough, when you go through the Dead Sea Scrolls, Esther is never found in the collections. The law is never mentioned in the book of Esther. Prayer is never mentioned in the book of Esther, although fasting is. And there's a great deal of moral ambiguity in this book. There's lots of alcohol, sex, violence. I mean, it's that kind of story. So we don't have time this morning to read it all. But what I want to do is, and I would highly recommend that you do this in your quiet time. It's like 11 chapters. Just read them. Wouldn't take you that long. Read it this week. I want to go through this story this morning because I think there's a couple really key things that we can take from this ambiguous story that some people wonder why it was ever put in the Bible in the first place. But I think there's really key reasons, and the author was really quite brilliant. So let's take a look. We're going to run through a whole bunch of stuff here. It's all in this period, in this 483 time frame where we're looking at the book of Esther. So I'm going to be pulling from different pieces. If you want to have it up on your phone or in your Bible, we're going to be looking through a whole bunch of stuff. But here's how the whole story starts. Great storyteller. This is what happened during the time. I'm going to move down. The stage is a little crowded here. I'm going to come down here today. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. This is the Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. And at that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the province were present. Now, when you think of a banquet, what do you think? You think of like when we have a potluck, right? A banquet, okay? Not like this at all. This banquet lasted 6 months, okay? So for, now you can see he's third year, he's in power, he's consolidated his power, and it says, and we're told that for 6 months, he basically had an ongoing party that never stopped. And it was for all the important people came, and the whole purpose of this party was to display his wealth and his power to all the nobles and all the people that were supposed to be serving him. I mean, and by the way, we know from other sources that Xerxes liked parties. He liked drinking. His anger was well known. But he decided he was going to do this. He wanted to exhibit this. And so he had 6 months worth of this power. I mean, just picture the indulgence. It's like seeing the Oscars and the Academy Awards and having that every night for 6 months. Just crazy. All the cream of the crop. The most famous people in the nation were there all the time. No political speeches were allowed, right? Because he was the king. And then at the end, so he does this for 6 months, and then it says, okay, now we've done this, it's drawing to a close, at the end we're going to blow this whole thing out. And so at the very end, for 1 week, he opened the doors and everybody was invited. Whole city. This is where they let out all the stops. Here's how we're told about it. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink with no restrictions. For the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. This was party, right? This is 7 days of people being completely bombed, okay? This is just what was going on. I mean, it's crazy. And the men are partying, and it is, of course, a little different than today. So the men are partying. The women are actually partying with the queen in a different part of the palace. And on the very last day of the party, seventh day, king's totally drunk. And he gets this wonderful idea, hey, my wife is gorgeous. I want to show her off. So he sends a messenger to his wife and says, why don't you come on out? Now think about this, if you're the queen. You're being asked to come and stand in front of all the men so they can all ogle how beautiful you are. And she did what most women would do, and she said, yeah, no, not coming. The problem was, this wasn't modern times. This was way back then. The king is furious because now he's drunk, he's been embarrassed in front of all the guests, and he is angry. So, he consults his advisors, he pulls his closest advisors, he says, what do I do? What do I do about this? And they said, whoa, you cannot let this go unpunished. If you don't do something about this, women are beginning to think for themselves. Right? Women are going to start to think they have a voice in their home. You cannot let this, you need to ditch the queen and send out an edict that men are in charge of their homes everywhere. King says, oh, that sounds good, and so he does it. His anger subsides, the righteous fury, the queen's been kicked out. And all of a sudden, he's lonely. Because when he cooled down, he realized, what did I do? So he does what any king would do in that situation. He holds a beauty pageant. I got to find another queen. And so he has this beauty pageant. They basically choose the most gorgeous women from all over the kingdom. He bring them on in. They have 12 months of beauty treatments, everything they could do to get these people in. They would go into these beauty treatments. And then each woman, this is how it worked, each woman had one night. So they'd prepare for a year. You got one night with the king, and then you moved on, and in somewhere near, the king was going to find the queen. So that sets up the whole story of Esther. Sounds great, doesn't it? Good Bible story. All right. Telling you, man, it's good stuff in here. Now, in the city of Susa was a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, this is where we get introduced to the protagonists in our story. Mordecai, son of Jair, son of Shammai, the son of Kish, okay, who had been carried into exile. So in other words, his grandfather or great-grandfather had been brought in as part of the exile by Nebuchadnezzar, and he was taken captive. Now, Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. That is a very political way of saying that, right? Basically, she's gorgeous. And Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and her mother died. And so Esther ends up being taken as one of the women into the citadel to be vying for the king's affections. And what was interesting is in this process, she gets the favor of the attendants, she gets the favor of the eunuchs. They all love her to death. They think she's amazing. So she gets put in the upper echelon. Right? We're going to give you the special beauty treatments. We're going to do more for you than we do for all the other women because we like you. And so they tutor to her, and they give her all these, so they talks about all these special beauty treatments she got. And when her turn with the king came, she got all this advice from the eunuchs. They said, this is what you should do. And she said, okay, I'll just listen to what you have to say. And she wins. She wins the favor of the king. King says, you are it. I want you to be my new queen. She's elevated from peasant Jewish girl to the queen of the empire. It's amazing. And they had this great feast to celebrate, because that's what Xerxes did anytime anything happened. But we have this little tidbit that comes up. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. And you got to figure, in the middle of all this, she's surrounded by royalty and princes and nobles and their cousins and their sisters, and there's this Jewish girl from nowhere. And Mordecai said, just don't tell anybody. And then, by the way, the author gives us this little sidebar. If you're reading the story, he gives us a little sidebar on Mordecai. Because Mordecai worked for the king in some capacity. And there was one point where, in his capacity, overhears two guys plotting to kill the king. So he hears this assassination attempt. He goes to Esther. He says, Esther, I heard about this. You got to let the king know. She tells the king. She's giving all the credit to Mordecai. And they do some investigation. They find out these two guys were actually going to kill the king. They caught it before it happens. They execute both of them. And Mordecai gets all the credit. They write it down in the king's book of what had happened. Just kind of a little sidebar. It's like the author saying, put this in your back pocket. This is going to come back. But basically, it's like a fairy tale, kind of a Disney Aladdin-esque kind of thing, right? This little one rises to prominence. It's amazing. It's great. And then we get to chapter 3, and the author introduces our villain. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than all the other nobles. In other words, this guy now is the preeminent one. He's like king's right-hand guy, a Canaanite descendant. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him, but Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Don't know why, sure why. That did not make Haman very happy. When Haman saw that Mordecai wouldn't kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. And yet, having learned who Mordecai's people were, in other words, he had done some investigation. He knew that Mordecai was a Jew. He knew where his ancestors came from. And he says, having learned who Mordecai's people was, he scorned the idea of only killing Mordecai. I could kill Mordecai. I'm right hand of the king. I could get rid of this guy. You know what? I'm going to make it worse than that. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all of Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the entire kingdom of Xerxes. It's not good enough to kill him. This bothers me so much, I'm going to kill him and every single person of the same nationality. He wants genocide. So, he sweet-talks the king. He basically says, look, king, I'll give you billions of dollars. If you'll just do this, there's these people. You don't even know about them, but they're kind of scattered in among our people. They're seditious. They're dangerous. You really want nothing to do with them, king. I'll take care of it all. You just got to sign the paper. I'll make sure we are going to kill them all, and it'll make your king a safer place. The king, kind of being a drunken idiot at this point, just says, yeah, sure, it sounds great. Signs the paper, says, I don't even need your money. Go whatever, do whatever you want to do. And so Haman gets his permission, and he says, well, when are we going to do this? And so he pulls out a dice called a pur, P-U-R, and he rolls the dice to pick what month they're going to kill all the Jews. And it comes up with this date, which was basically almost a full year out. And so they send out an edict to everybody. On this date, anybody who wants to can kill any Jew without any repercussions and take all their stuff. And everybody in the kingdom went, what is going on here? But the die had been cast, and the stage had been set. But the Jews understood the danger here, And now we come to chapter 4. And chapter 4 in Esther is the pivot point for the entire story. You guys know what a pivot point is? Pivot points are those points in history where everything hinges and everything turns and everything goes a completely new direction because of one single event. And that's what we see. Because Mordecai heard about all this, and he actually gets a copy of the edict. He calls to Esther. Esther's kind of insulated. She's in the harem. She's in the palace. She doesn't even know what's going on. So Mordecai sends for her, and he says, do you understand what's going to happen? He shows her the edict. He says, this is what's going to happen to our people. He says, can you please go to the king and beg for our lives? You would think she would say, sure. That wasn't her answer. Here's how she responds. She responds to Mordecai. She says, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death unless the king extends the golden scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. And what she's saying is, look, you don't just get to go to the king. If you just show up to beg the king for something, you're dead. Because you don't bother the king unless he asks for you. And if you're really lucky and you go in and he's in a good mood, he'll extend his royal scepter and you can come up and kiss the scepter and then he might listen to you. But she says, I haven't seen my husband in a month. He's not that interested right now. If I go, I could die. Even though she's the queen, she just couldn't waltz in and ask for stuff. There's protocol. And here's where we come to the core of the entire story of Esther. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from some other place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. See, you are where you are right now because that was God's intention. Did you know that? You are uniquely placed where you are to make a difference. And what Mordecai is saying is, don't shrink back now. Don't step away now. And you can see, you can picture Esther kind of getting this message and kind of going, oh, you know, I kind of knew this. I didn't want to do this. And you can kind of, maybe she has this discussion with the ladies that are around her, but at some point she kind of settles in, takes a deep breath, squares her shoulders. And Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, go and gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, day or night. I and my attendants will fast as you do. And when this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. This is where God has me. So I'm in. And I can't predict what's going to happen, but I'm in. For such a time as this. Do you ever ask yourself, why am I positioned where I am? Why do I work where I work? Why do I live where I live in the community I am? Why do I go to school where I go to school? Why does Hope Chapel as a church continue to exist? Why are we here? Have you ever stopped to consider that whatever situation you are in right now is because God, you put you there for such a time as this? These kind of things have happened all through the year. You know, the Reformation, which changed the entire world, began when one man got fed up with the indulgences of the church and tacked up some thesis on a door, and it kicked off something that changed the planet. You know, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand on June 28th, 1914, started a chain of events that killed 40 million people called World War I. And you could go on and on. I mean, you can look for these events. And there are thousands of illustrations, the greatest preachers and the theologians and the influence can almost all point to a specific place, a specific event, and usually a specific person who changed everything for them. In fact, honestly, I've listened to a lot of your stories over the years. And like mine, they tend to pivot on specific words or events or things that have happened to you from somebody in some place. A lot of them are negative, a lot of them are positive. And I can look back over my life, like I shared earlier, and see all kinds of key people that shaped my life and what I thought and what I decided. Most of us can, but we rarely think about it from the other side, saying, I am positioned where I am because God wants me to be an influencer on somebody else's pivot point. All the events of Esther's life, good and bad, have led her to this point, to have an influence, to change an outcome. And a couple weeks ago, we saw Abraham, this whole idea of giving God your yes when he asks you to do something. Esther comes to play grips with this and says, okay, if that's true and I'm here where I'm supposed to be, then I'm going to give God my yes. Accepting the consequences, but doing what she knew she would do. So what happened? Good story. They wait 3 days because she said fast for 3 days. And after 3 days, she puts on her best clothes, her best royal robes, and she approaches the throne room of the king. And I can imagine her heart must have been pounding, right? She's probably sweating like crazy, thinking I needed more talcum powder. I don't know. She's like, I don't know what's going to happen here. And as she approached, the king sees her, and he is thrilled to death. Ah, it's Esther. So he extends the royal scepter. She approaches it and touches it. And I mean, he isn't just happy to see her. He must have been ecstatic because he says, what do you want? Anything, up to half my kingdom, it's all yours. Okay, she made a good impression. She was wearing something nice. I don't know what was going on there, right? But something got him pretty excited. And Esther is way more clever than to just blurt it out. So what she tells the king is she says, I just want you to have dinner with me and bring Haman. Can you do that? That's all I'm asking. Just come for dinner. King says, oh, I can do that. Sure, absolutely. So I did. The king sent for Haman, and the three of them have this amazing dinner together, right? Picture how Haman's feeling. I am the only guy in the kingdom in this meal with the king and the queen. I am it. I mean, I am so honored here. It's just amazing. And after they're done the dinner, the king says, okay, this was great. Now, Esther, what is it that you really want? Up to half the kingdom. He's in really good spirits because she's been feeding him lots of alcohol, right? He's like, absolutely. She's very sneaky. So she says, well, this is all I want. Come back tomorrow night. I'm going to do another one of these dinners for you and Haman. And when you guys come tomorrow, I'll tell you what it is that I really want. King says, okay, I can do that. Haman's all excited. And here's where the story takes a crazy turn. Because Haman is feeling awesome. I mean, he's got money. He's got the king's ear. He's got power. He is the only one invited to have dinner with the king and even had this revenge that he has planned on Mordecai and all his people. I mean, that's kind of taken care of. It didn't even cost him a whole ton of money. He gets to commit genocide on this race of people. I mean, he is in good spirits. Mostly. Because as he left, he saw Mordecai who would not bow down and he says, I got all this stuff and none of it gives me any satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. And he goes home, talks to his wife and his family, and they said, look, I know this is all going to get taken care of 11 months from now, but you don't have to wait that long. You're the king's favorite. In fact, go back to the king, he's in good spirit, and ask him if you can just kill Mordecai tomorrow. Just have him executed before you go to dinner. Haman's like, oh, that's a good idea. So he heads back to the palace to ask the king. Meanwhile, just as he's thinking about all this, the king can't sleep, right? After dinner, he's gone back to bed. He's restless. You've all had those nights, right? He's like, how do I go to sleep? Well, they didn't have white noise machines, so he calls the scribe. He says, just read me the events of my reign. I mean, talk about a narcissist, right? He's like, just tell me about all the great things that happened to me and all the great things I've done. So they're reading, and as they read, they come to the story of Mordecai, who found the two assassins and saved the king's life. And the king says, oh, time out. Did we ever reward him for that? Like, no, we never gave him anything. As he's saying this, Haman is walking into the palace. And the king says, hey, is there any nobles or someone out there? And they're like, yeah, Haman's here. So he calls Haman in. And here's what he asks Haman. What should be done for the man that the king delights to honor? And Haman, of course, having just had dinner with the king and the queen, figures Xerxes must be talking about him. And so he thinks, oh my goodness, this is my opportunity. What can I? He says, I'll tell you what you should do. If you want to honor someone, put him on the king's horse. Everybody knows it's the king's horse. Put the king's clothes on him. Put the king's crown on his head and pick one of your greatest nobles to lead the horse around, shouting to everyone how amazing this guy is. And this is what is done for the man who the king wants to honor. And the king said, that is a fantastic idea. Go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just as you suggested for Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the king's gate, and do not neglect anything you just told me. Just marvelous, right? Haman is utterly humiliated. He's barely had time. I mean, he has to do everything the king said. I mean, picture this. He was going to the king to ask him to be dead, and instead he's leading him around on the king's horse, telling everybody how amazing he is. I mean, he's enraged and humiliated. And so he goes home after this. He barely has time to change because he's got dinner again that night. His family are like, hey, I know that was really humiliating, but it's okay. You're still going to deal with this. You're still going to win in the end. You know, just get ready. Go be with the king and the queen. And at dinner, the king asks again. After all the dinner, he says to Esther, okay, this has been wonderful. What is it that you want? And in this moment of amazing drama, she says, if I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, will you grant me my life? This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. And boy, you got to picture the tension. Because the king's like standing up going, who would dare do such a thing? Who would do this? You're the queen. What kind of person would do this? And this amazing, dramatic moment, Esther points at Haman and says, that guy. Remember, the king has a temper. The king just goes off, right? You can just see all the pieces begin to click into place of all the things that happened. And he is so enraged. He can't even control himself. He leaves the room. He's like, because he's going to do something crazy. And when this happens, Haman is freaking out because he realizes, I'm dead. I am going to be killed. And he's like, my only hope is to get mercy from Esther. So he turns to Esther and he goes and just basically falls on her pleading for his life. And as he does, as the king comes in and says, what are you trying to do? You're trying to rape my wife while I'm gone? And they took him, and one of his servants, obviously someone who didn't like Haman, said, hey, boss. He just put a stake out there. He wanted to impale Mordecai on it. You should use it. King said, that's right. Take him and impale him on the post. And they took Haman and they executed him. Now, the king could not alter his own decree. That was just the law. You know, when the king made a decree and he signed it and he put his ring on it, they couldn't change it. But he still wanted to answer Esther's request. So he issues a second decree that gave the Jews the right to defend themselves and even attack those who wanted them dead. And when the day came 11 months later, the Jews rose up with the king's full backing and defended themselves against anybody who wanted them dead, attacked and killed thousands of people, and not only saved their own race, but promoted themselves in the empire, including, by the way, exterminating all of Haman's sons who were in on the plot. And in the end, Mordecai is elevated to the king's right hand. The book actually ends this way. Great ending to the book. Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes. Remember who was that spot just a little while ago? Right? Haman. Preeminent among the Jews and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of the Jews. And the celebration of Purim is still celebrated today, right? In fact, it's March 9, 10 this year. And it's called Purim because the dice, pure, P-U-R, was what was rolled to determine the fate of the Jews. What an amazing story. For such a time as this, the reason we can do this and why the author did this in such a masterful way, he's inviting the reader into this for this very reason. We sang about it in our last song. God is working even when I don't see it. Esther just happened to find favor with the manager of the harem to get the best treatment. Esther just happened to catch the eye of the king. Mordecai just happened to hear an overflow, a plot to overthrow the king. The roll of the dice to kill the Jews just happened to be 11 months later from the original edict, giving them lots of time to deal with this. The king just happened to not be able to sleep the night that Haman was going to ask for Mordecai's death. Haman just happened to be in the courtyard when the king wanted to honor Mordecai. The queen just happened to be a Jew when the lives of the Jewish people were threatened. Haman just happened to be begging for his life with the king, with the queen, when the king came back in and sealed his fate. My friends, God is always working. Everything around you, in all the lives of the people you know, your neighbors, your coworkers, your kids, your parents, your friends, he's at work. And God has put you in a place for such a time as this, for those people. And I think what's most encouraging in the end is that he works even despite poor choices and moral ambiguity, right? He used Esther, he used Mordecai. They were not, by all accounts in this, really good Jews. They made a lot of choices in here that went right against the law, against the Torah, against everything. God said, that's okay, I'm going to use you anyway. And why that's so encouraging is you might be sitting here this morning saying, well, then I can't be where God wants me to be because the reason I'm here is because I made so many bad choices in my life. And I made bad relationship choices and bad money choices and bad job choices and all these choices. And it's just, my life's a mess to get where it is. And you know what? God is big enough to say, that's okay. I've got you exactly where I want you for such a time as this. You're never disqualified. And just because you made bad choices doesn't mean that God doesn't have you exactly where he wants you. Because he's bigger than your circumstances, bigger than your choices, and he takes his story and he weaves it through all of that. God has put you where you are for such a time as this. And you know, he modeled this in his son Jesus. Jesus came when the time was right for just a time like this. And where Esther was there to save the Jewish people from annihilation, Jesus came to save the entire world from destruction. And when the time was right, Jesus came, born of a virgin, raised in a backwater village to disciple 12 men who would change the world. And then to die to bring us into family and give us access to the Heavenly Father. And now he asks us to do the same. I put you where you are for such a time as this. No one else can do what you can do. And if you don't, God might well bring something else along the way to save or help that other person. But you'll miss out. And you may well suffer because of it. So don't shrink back. Step in. Because God has you where you are for such a time as this.